everyone. So we have a very special guest today. I'm chatting to Tony Salvador. So Tony is the principal of Radical Flux. He was a senior fellow of Center of Public Service. And Tony and I used to work together many, many years ago, back when we were at Intel, where he was part of the kind of anthropology group that Intel had. So he actually worked really closely with Genevieve Bell, who's the lead who runs the Autonomy Agency and Assurance Innovation Institute, and a senior fellow at Intel still. And Tony is also has been a really great TED Talk speaker. He's had a few sessions in TED Talks. So we're really lucky to have Tony here with us. And we want to really learn from Tony in terms of how do we generate change insights by better understanding employees. So Tony's going to share with us a lot of his great experience and the work he's done in research and with lots of different companies in this area. So welcome, Tony.
Thanks, Yuan. Glad to be here.
Yeah, so Tony, tell us more about your work, because you know your work is one of those things that's just super, super interesting, because as you know, like in recent years, the whole area of human-centered design and UX and behavior economics has just expanded like crazy. But the whole area around anthropology has existed for such a long time. And it's just really great that companies like Intel and others have really leveraged that within the research and really used it to get better insights into people and customers and employees, and use that to actually design better processes, programs, and products.
Sure. Let me come at this a little bit from, I'm going to say a few words about this. Is that all right? I won't go on too long.
Just That's great.
Fair warning, but I'll say a few words. I came at this work from an engineering psychology point of view. And in engineering psychology, one of the things that we learn is that human factors work, or thinking about designing technology to support humans, came out of World War II. It came out of the fact that people were building airplanes that could pull G-forces that were stronger than people could take. And the pilots were passing out and crashing their planes and dying. And this was very bad if you were trying to train pilots to go and kill other people instead of just die on their own. So this was not a good plan for a war effort. And they figured out that maybe they should be designing the plane so that it actually takes the human into account. And this started the whole notion of ergonomics and bioengineering and that kind of thing. Now you sort of move forward in years and people started thinking about designing systems that took into account how people thought and how they think, how they make decisions, that kind of thing. And now you move forward even further and you say, well, what is it that people like and what could they use and how do they live and why do they live that way? And how do technology sort of not only fit into those lives, but enhance them in some way or change them in some way? And how do those technologies get adopted? How do people market them? How do they think about them? What happens when people reject them? Why do they reject them? So really trying to understand human systems and understanding people and how they live and thrive and survive and go to work and play and raise families. And that's kind of the work that we do, trying to understand all of that and think about where technology can go and where it should go. The work that I do now, before this, I worked for about 30 years in the tech industry, and most of it at Intel Corporation, where we make microprocessors. And the company sits at a pretty interesting place in the ecosystem as a sort of foundational component to computing. The work I do now, since I've been sort of retired from Intel, is thinking about what people have called wicked problems, sort of significant social challenges that are difficult to characterize, difficult to resolve, that maybe make use of the skills that I have. So I try to think about what are some difficult social challenges and how to start characterizing them, framing them, and working with them. That's most of the work that I do now.
Yeah, it sounds so interesting because, for a lot of us that work in change management, we're typically, in that typical corporate mold where we're implementing lots of these change programs. We work with, senior leaders, operations managers, and different employee groups and stakeholders. I guess a lot of our work is fairly, I would say, standard in terms of, okay, we would apply, we tend to apply similar approaches for different programs within a company. But yet, you know, just hearing you talk about how a lot of your work is very research-based, is really finding out about people's behaviors, interactions with different systems and technologies. I mean, when we think about it, that's pretty much what we do. Like we roll out and implement systems and technologies for employees. How do we really sort of do better at understanding some of those behaviors and you know, some of the research findings that you found over the years? And I'm just wondering, what are some of the ways in which we could do better to, you know, really deeply understand some of those things that really trigger and drive the behavior and the emotions of people that we work with within a company?
Okay, yeah, that's kind of a big question. I think the first thing that comes to mind is what is changing, right? What is the level of change? What is it that people are going to, you know, come up against or expect or have to understand? Maybe let me tell you a little story, right? Suppose that you're a farmer, right? Just a farmer, just a, you know, regular dirt farmer, and you know, it's a little while ago, and you were using a shovel. And you were using the shovel to turn over the dirt. And so you were using the shovel by you know, using your hand underhanded, and you were pushing the shovel in the ground, maybe using your foot to get it further into the ground, and then picking up and turning over the dirt. And I'm just making this up as we go, so let's see if it works. But then somebody comes along and says, hey, I got this thing. It's called a pickaxe, right? It's going to help you turn over the dirt. And so now a pickaxe, of course, who knows this, but you use it overhand, right? It's got a blade in the front instead of a shovel, and you use it and you dig into the dirt and you pull out the dirt that way. So in a lot of cases, a pickaxe is actually a lot better than a shovel for breaking up the dirt. It really is. Mm-hmm. But it also uses very different muscles, right? You have to now lift up over your head and you have to swing down. That takes some getting used to. It takes some getting used to become adept at it. It takes muscle memory getting used to it. People kind of had the shovel thing and they're doing pretty well with the shovel. And now you've given them a choice saying, you can keep your shovel maybe, or not, you can take this pickaxe, but you have to choose. And that's one way of thinking about sort of just a system change, right? If I'm going to get a new writing document or a new management system or something like this for supply chain or whatever, you're just giving them a new pickaxe or a different tool. And the question is, to me, the first question I would ask is, what do they think about this pickaxe? How are you presenting the pickaxe to them or these other systems? Do they have a choice about the pickaxe? Did they get a chance to sort of investigate the pickaxe first? Why do you want them to use the pickaxe? What's going to happen to them if they use the pickaxe? Does it seem like a really good thing up front, but then your body wears out a lot sooner than the shovel? I mean, what are all these questions that come? And so to me, there's a whole lot of questions around control and questions around trust and, you know, locus of control, and how much do they trust the people giving them the pickaxe? Are they being betrayed in any way? Have they been betrayed before? What's the relationship that they actually have with the management? Is there going to be some backlash? Was there backlash from before? Do the people have sort of, are they a little bit more tepid or a little bit fearful? Is there more of a fixed mindset or more of a growth mindset associated with what they're doing? I mean, I have all these questions about the level of change. Is it just a tool? But, you know, then you can actually sort of up the change and you can say, all right, what we're really going to do is we're going to change, like, you know, the mission of our company or the main product line or our branding, right? Or the way we have to come to work, or we're going to work in these kind of groups and not those kind of groups. And now it's not just a pickaxe. Now it's a whole suite of tools, and it's going to be a whole different set of people. And you know what? We're not going to actually be farming on this land anymore. We're going to be farming on the side of a hill, and it's going to be drier and not as wet, and it's going to change the whole thing. That opens up a whole set of other questions. And at this point, I think that people are going to start asking questions around, well, what am I giving up? What am I losing? What am I getting? But you know, I know what I have now, and I kind of like it. So if I get this new thing, is it going to be better or worse? I don't know. And then you have all those other questions from before. So I start thinking about things like, you know, people's aversion to loss, right? I start thinking about people's sort of desire or a bias towards maintaining the status quo. Everything's working out. It's okay. There's probably stakes involved, right? Is this, you know, something I have to learn or relearn? Is it something that's going to take my job and maybe, you know, put my family in a bad situation? The stakes can actually rise and fall. So I just have a lot of questions about that up front. We can dig into those things, but that's where those are the kinds of questions that I immediately start asking when I hear what you asked.
That's fantastic. This could almost be like a very really meaty checklist for a lot of our change practitioners. But let's talk a little bit more about aversion to loss, because I think that's a really key one that we don't really think much about in change. We'd love to hear more about, you know, the research that you found in the past and how that's really affected people's behavior.
Sure. So people seem to have an aversion to loss. And in some of the research that people have done, a lot of times they do this in terms of, you know, monetary loss and gain. And it seems that on the whole, people have to lose more than 2x what they otherwise might gain before they actually choose the thing, the gain side, right? So there's really sort of an aversion or a fear of losing something that exceeds the pleasure one might get from any gain, right? And that loss aversion also seems to sort of percolate, if you will, to other things, not just, you know, I'm going to give you a chance to win $2, but you might lose $4. People are going to focus on the $4 thing. This aversion to loss, losing something that you have for the chance of getting something better, it's not a bad rule of thumb, really, when you think about it. If you have sort of things going along all right, and you're feeding your family and things are okay, and, you know, maybe it's a long time ago and you're, you know, a farmer and you're having to get food from the land and everything's going all right, you're going to be really careful before you make a change because you could go hungry, right? And I think that carries over into our modern age where people are fearful of loss. And in fact, when people look at sort of brain studies around this issue, loss aversion and fear are very closely related. It's sort of the amygdala lights up. And so fear is a super strong emotion, right? And so if I have a concern about loss and it lights up the same places in the brain as fear, then it's a fear of loss, right? Fear is like super powerful. People react to fear. They don't always make the best decisions when they're afraid, right? Making decisions when you're fearful is not the best way to go, but being afraid limits your willingness, your desire to sort of have a growth mindset, to be more open-minded towards what it is that the change is. So fear is going to actually close things down and go, I'm not so sure about that, right? And, and that's a pretty tough emotion to get through. So if somebody comes in and misreads an audience, for example, and comes in and goes, this is going to be great. We're changing this. We're going to do this. We're changing the name of the company. We're doing this. And people go, oh my God, no, right? You've immediately shut them down. And it's going to be very hard to open up their minds again, right? And that beginning part is probably pretty darn important. I'll stop there.
Yeah, look, it's so interesting because when I'm thinking about this, a lot of us that are implementing and managing change programs, we are working on those big hitting, you know, new systems, new branding, new like restructuring or whatever it is, a new business model. And there is a ton of changes that go with each of those large programs. And I guess listening to you made me realize that, you know, when those employees are kind of in that situation where they're thinking, oh my gosh, all these things are changing. When I'm going through the list, I would imagine that a lot of those things will cause their kind of aversion to loss. I guess what I'm thinking is what are some of the tips that we could really think about to help them with that? I mean, how do we, mitigate their aversion to loss when there is quite a lot of change going on? And for example, like they're working for a firm where, you know, because the industry changes, the competitive landscape, we know there's going to be more and more change coming, and it's not really a choice. But yet, if this is what we're seeing from employees, what are some of the things that we could do to really help them?
So I'm going to, this is not my area of expertise, but I'll take a stab at it here. I think the first thing is full on transparency. right? I think that one of the things that happens, especially in this day and age, is, so let me just back up a little bit. The first thing to do is to understand what is the relationship that employees have with the company and with management, and what's management's relationship with the employees. A lot of times management likes to think that their employees are like, everybody's loyal, we're all on board, we're all in this together, right? That kind of thing. When in fact, not really, right? It's, you know, management wants the employees to do the work that they need to do, and employees are kind of for a transaction, right? You know, they love it when people are nice, and they love it when people, you know, are decent to them and all that, but yeah, they're kind of there for like, I'm doing my work, you're paying me, right? When it comes down to it. Now, there's all kinds of discussions about loyalty and all of that kind of thing, and that varies with the kind of company and with the role of management and all that. But having a really honest assessment of the relationship of employees with the company and being really transparent about why the change is coming is important. One thing that's not going to work is if there's a history or if there's a sniff of exploitation here. It's like, we're making these changes, it's good for all of us, but it's really good for me, right? My bonus is going to go through the roof, and you guys are going to not, you know, some of you are going to get laid off. It's just not the best program to have. And people can sense this coming a mile away. So they're going to, people can sense dishonesty. So the first thing to me would be, all right, it's got to be honest, right? I think another sense is sort of thinking about how to involve people in that process, right? Where is that sense of control? Do they have a sense of control over the change? Or is this something that's just happening to them? The more that something like this is happening to you, the more of a transaction you're gonna have. The more that people have a say in what's going on, or at least are heard in what's going on, genuinely heard, then the more they'll actually feel that they've had a say in this and have some control, and maybe it moves a little bit better, is my sense, right? I think those two things right there are a good way to start off that conversation. Be, you know, have a really clear assessment of the relationship, be really honest about what it is that you're actually trying to do. And what was the third thing that I said? Oh, and offer a sense of, you know, make sure there's a sense of control, really hear what they're saying and what they're doing. I think these would be sort of upfront to me, the starting place. Yeah.
That's great. Because I mean, when I listen to you, I love how you talk about that. It's really critical for us to spend the time and the effort and the investment to listen to employees, to understand what's really going on and not just make assumptions. Especially when, you know, in companies that move very fast, those perceptions are not still right. They change all the time. So how do we, you know, continually dip in and be able to assess their sentiments? But the other thing, I mean, just listening to you as well is, with your background, you do a lot of research. For us in change management, a lot of what we do is, I guess, maybe quite light from your perspective. We just tend to, we send out quick surveys, we ask opinions in a workshop. We probably, you know, maybe you schedule a bit of a session to listen to focus groups. That's probably the most that we do. From your perspective, what are some of the things that you found to work really well within the company from a research perspective? And I'm really keen to kind of, you know, listen to how you would approach the whole area around research of people's opinions.
I'm a little, I guess I'm just, I'm a little wavery here, wavering a little bit. On the one hand, some of the work that I might do, the work that I would do probably depends on the nature of the company and the kind of relationships that exist within the company. If it's a company that is, let's say, the entire reason that company exists is to make more money, right? So like something, maybe a bank or a financial services company, I'm being a little bit capricious, but just for, and or it's a company that has a deeply sort of human mission, maybe social services in some kind, helping homeless people or whatever, right? So that you're putting two ends of the thing. I think a part of it is going to be, what is the nature of, and maybe this is my own bias, but I'm going to say, what is the nature of the service orientation of the management toward the employees, right? And I don't mean this in a syrupy way. I really mean, like, to what extent is management actually enabling the employees to do the work that needs to be done and really, really striving to do that? How much sort of skin in the game does management really have in the work that's being done? How much personal skin in the game is there? How much risk, how much loss, what's the risk of loss for them, right, when this change is going? Are they really kind of with us, or is it an exploitative kind of environment, right? If it's an exploitative kind of environment, and like that's you know, a financial institution, I don't want to make fun of banks, but some financial institutions, right? If it's an exploitative environment, then maybe that's the deal. Maybe everybody just knows that coming in. It's like, you know, I'm here to make as much money as possible and then I'm out of here, right, kind of thing. Maybe that's the deal and that's fine. The problem is when the deal isn't the deal, right? When people think it's one thing and it's really something else, that's where I think that there's a challenge. And so I guess the first bit of work that I would do would be to understand what is the nature of the company? What is the nature, what are the nature of the relationships people have, you know, with management, who are the decision makers, I assume? What's the nature of those relationships? What's the nature of the management's relationship to the company? What's the nature of the people's relationship to the work and to their coworkers? And trying to understand that. And then I might start moving forward and saying, look, if it's a really, you know, if it's a total transaction, maybe we do it in one way, right? Here's the reasons we're going to make more money doing this. Some of you are going to lose your job. Some of you are going to be working harder. And some of you is this. That's the deal. If you don't like it, you're out, kind of thing, right? And the other, they might just say and go, all right, I got it. That's cool. Yeah, I'm going to go get another job, or I'm with you, right? But if you said that to the first company, right, then that's going to be hard, right? They're going to be like, oh man, we all put in effort here to do things. So I think my first approach would be to understand the nature of the relationships, I think. And then the second approach would be to understand what is the nature of the change. Right. To what extent is that change something that's a habit, shovel versus pickaxe? Or to what extent is that change something that's more really sort of systemic? We're not growing vegetables anymore. We're going to be making cars, or we're not, you know, farming flat land, or farming on hills, or, you know, to what extent is the system changing overall? And what, how much risk is it to the employees' livelihoods, frankly? Right, to their status, right, their jobs, their family, their commitments, their, you know, status in the community, all of that kind of thing. Yeah.
Right, right, absolutely. So I guess taking the next step, so if I'm a new sort of change manager in a company and I'm working on this project, and I'm trying to understand what are some of those sentiments and history and the relationship between the senior managers and the employees, what are some of the ways in which I can really gain like a deeper sense of insight into what's really happening versus what people are telling me? And what are some of those techniques that you've found to really work?
That's a little bit tough. I think probably if I had to try to get a quick take on what is going on in a company, I'd want people to tell me stories of when someone else was especially good to them. Right? I think I'd want to hear that. And then I'd want to hear stories of when people were indifferent or maybe bad to them. I think, you know, so I might ask, I'm just making this up now, but I might actually try to talk to management and to people and say, can you tell me a story when somebody in the company, you know, you needed something and somebody was especially good to you? And then I might ask questions around that. Is this typical? Was that really one-off? Were you super surprised? Is this something you expect? You know, would somebody else tell a story about you in that way? You know, these are questions that might follow from that. And then I might also ask for the other side, right? Just thinking to tell me a story when you needed something and people said, no, I can't do it. You know, I got something to do, or, you know, or whatever. And you felt that people didn't treat you right, right? Or you were disrespected in some way. So I'd be starting to look for those stories of when people felt like they belong and when people felt like they were betrayed. Right. Belonging and betrayal are two, again, sort of super powerful emotions. People really have a need to belong, right? We're a social being. Evolutionarily, we do much better socially than we do alone, some people notwithstanding. Betrayal is an incredibly strong emotion, right? So if people feel betrayed, that it's pretty hard sometimes to get over that. Sometimes people don't. Sometimes they do, depending on their mindset. But yeah. I might ask those questions to start.
So it's almost like those key events that really shape a lot of their perceptions and how they feel about the relationship, isn't it?
I think so. I think that this is something that Genevieve does. The stories we tell ourselves really matter, right? So the stories that people would tell me about those kinds of issues, those stories are related to belonging and betrayal, let's say, right? We're just creating a little research framework right here. Those stories are related to sort of belonging and betrayal. And I'd want to understand the nature of those stories. I'd probably be thinking about what they're saying in those stories as well, because probably everybody has a story one way or another. So I'd be looking for their prevalence. I'd be looking for the way they answer. If you say, hey, can you tell me a time when sort of, you know, a manager did something really awesome for you or something, right, that was meaningful to you? And they have to go, oh, let me think about that. Gosh, I don't, you know, maybe, right, if they start answering that way, then that counts to me as part of the story, right? To me as the ethnographer. If they go, oh my God, it happens all the time, right? They're, you know, I know Yuan, he's an awesome manager, he's done this, he helps me out. Everybody loves this guy, right? Oh, are there other managers like that? Oh my God, the managers are awesome. People love the managers, right? If that that counts as a story to me, right? That counts as a data point. So sort of getting a bit of that affect that goes along with the story is sort of how I read it as well. And then I start making some hypotheses of, look, I think this is what's going on. I think that some people are really, you know, are really loyal and have a relationship to the management and the company. And some, most people though are really transactional. They're really here just to, you know, make money, and that's just what they want to do or whatever. You know, or there's a whole lot of, you know, strong feeling about the company. People really feel like they belong to it, right? They, you know, they, a brew pub, and we love the beer, and we love the whole ethos, and we love the brand, and we love, right, you know, that kind of thing would be, you know, change is hard there. It's really hard.
It's great.
Hard to belong, so, and then to not belong.
Yeah,
it's hard to unlearn something. You know, if you know how to use a shovel and they give you a pickaxe, system change, right? You know, computer system change. It's not that you have to learn a new one. It's that you have to unlearn the old one and then learn. Right. Right. The technologies we use shape us as much as we shape them. Right. That shovel is going to, you know, cause my body to change in a particular way. And I have to sort of slow that down and then use a pickaxe. So I got to change everything. So the technologies affect us. Right. And it's hard to unbelong. It's hard to unlearn. It's hard to do those unthings first before you do them again. It's
absolutely. And I love how you talked about really listening to the way people tell their stories, what's unsaid as well as what's said, like using your example. So how, were they struggling to come up with the examples? What, you know, what were some of the expressions? All those things are really valuable, isn't it?
I think so. I think that any, you know, ethnographer worth their salt would think so as well. You know, I was working with a friend of mine, Ken, and we were working in Brazil where there was a translator, and the translator was translating what she thought they meant. And Ken knew enough of Brazilian Portuguese to know that he wasn't getting the actual stories. And it turns out that the people were actually answering questions with little stories and little vignettes. And those stories really mattered. And what we were getting were little summaries of what was being said. And that was not nearly good enough for us, right? The fact that they were answering in little stories was already itself really interesting, right? That they weren't just giving some instrumental answer, but were saying, oh, well, you know, this happens like this, and let me tell you a little story about that. And it implies relationships, it implies sensibilities, it implies the kinds of values that exist. It implies a lot of other things that are not necessarily said or voiced.
Yeah, that's just incredible, because I love the work that you guys do to, you know, with different cultures and really picking up on a lot of those, you know, I guess people's preconceived notions of who they are, what they're working with, their environment, a lot of those things, you know, pretty much the same as what we do with employees within the change context. But I think you guys apply a very rigorous, I guess, approach to really tease out a lot of those insights, right? You know, within our sort of, you know, typical corporate mode within large companies, we tend to just implement these projects. I love how you really stress the fact that, you know, really observing and listening to people's words and how to tell their stories can give us a lot of insights.
Yeah, I think so. You know, as we talk here, I was thinking a little bit as we're talking and I'm listening to how you're how you're hearing too. I think that I'm going to suppose or hypothesize that one of the main issues around change management, if you will, or just changing anything in the system, has to do with the underlying relationships that people have with each other within a particular institution. And what is the nature of those relationships, and how do those relationships enable those people to realize their own potential, right, if you will. And how do those changes and how does those relationships enable people to realize their collective potential, right? To the extent that they can realize both, that's awesome. They're moving in the right direction. To the extent that a change is going to enable more of that, and they believe it, and that it ends up doing that, and there's evidence to suggest it will, then change management becomes relatively easy, right? To the extent that it starts to diminish that in some way, or they feel that they're being exploited or betrayed, those relationships start to fracture a little, then I think change management gets to be really hard. And the objective issues of change, or today we change this system, tomorrow we change that, tomorrow the next day we do this other thing, we have milestones to meet. Those milestones might be just totally relatively neutral. There's nothing, you know, no malintent at all in those changes. But if they're perceived that way, if they're perceived as being, you know, no one has any control, or if they're perceived as like, you didn't tell us this was going to happen, right, then there's other emotions that lay in on top of that. And that just changes the nature of the work entirely. So I might actually argue that the relationships really matter as a foundational element, and understanding them and how they're moving, how it's enabling them to realize potential is probably all bound up in those stories that, you know, that they tell.
Absolutely.
That they tell us, that kind of thing.
Because relationships really form trust or lack of, right, either within the teams or with the leaders, etc.
I think so.
So Tony, the other thing that we often experience in large companies is the fact that there's lots of different changes at the same time, and you know, it's a challenge, right? So I guess it's you know, similar to the environment of someone like a customer out there who is using lots of different things, that could be using multiple technologies, same within a corporate environment where we've got lots of changes going on. Is it harder from a kind of insight perspective to really tease out what they're going through when there's lots of things going on? And are there any, I guess, suggestions you have to better understand what people are going through when there's just multiple things that they're juggling with?
I don't know the answer to that. I think that on the one hand, I can imagine that if people have pretty strong relationships within the company, let's say, and there's a lot of changes, but there's a really good rationale, a well-understood rationale for those changes, and it has to happen, then I don't think the number of changes per se will really matter. Right now, if it's implemented super chaotically or whatever, that's a problem, right? But that's an operational problem, not a sort of management problem per se, right? Well, it is a management problem, but you see what I mean, I think, right? Sort of, you know, how something is implemented is different than what's being implemented or the number of changes. People might be on board for the number of changes, and then you want to see this, you know, thing executed pretty well. And so it might be a lot of changes, but if there's, you know, strong relationships and a sense of, you know, real genuine sense of urgency, and everybody believes it and nobody's being exploited, I don't think the number really matters other than, can you do it, right? On the other hand, if you're changing one little thing and relationships are fractured and people don't like each other or they don't trust each other and that sort of thing, that one thing might be really hard. So I see there's like a little 2x2 matrix, right? You know, strong, weak relationships, you know, maybe few, many things, and you can decide, you know, what cell you want to be in for your change management, how difficult it might actually be, right? And it'll be differently difficult if it's, you know, one thing, but everybody hates each other or whatever, then that one thing is just going to be really hard. You have to spend a lot of time and attention on sort of working through those sort of sociocultural differences or difficulties.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's, you know, a lot of things, but there's really good relationships, the difficulty there is probably going to be the program management of it, right? The instrumentality right. of it. It's like, okay, this gets aligned here, this gets slotted here, this gets delivered there, you know, that kind of thing, and making sure that's all really clear. But the sociocultural part of it, people might be just all on board and going like, all right, you know, what do we got to do? Let's do it. You know?
That's great. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, it just gets to the heart of, again, what drives people's perception and behavior and the relationship, as you mentioned. So Tony, my last question for you is, okay, so now, so imagine that we've, you know, spoken to different employee groups and leaders. We start to get a lot of the insights and we've captured the stories. What are some of the ways in which we could present that in a way that makes more impact from your experience?
Because
I guess there's a lot of different ways to present it, right?
I almost think that I don't know the answer to that question. I can imagine different ways of doing it. All of the ways that I would imagine have to do with, is it honest? Is it perceived as honest? Is it transparent? And do people have a say? So there's a part of me that would say, all right, I don't want to be the manager telling everybody that this is what we're going to do. Let's all tell each other what we're going to do, right? Mm-hmm. Let's bring in people from different parts of the organization, you know, so-and-so who works on the factory floor, so-and-so who works in accounting, so-and-so who works over here, whatever the system, you know, in play is, I'd have people come together and sort of say, all right, you know, why don't we talk about it? Why don't you tell me what you think the change needs to be? And, mm-hmm. and you know, and sort of roll it out in that way based on everything we've talked about, right? Something like that, that could work if it's a small enough company or a small enough department or something like that. If it's a really large system and you're changing over a big thing, we're rebranding the company, right? Then, you know, probably making the case earlier on and not just like presenting it one day. It's like, today we're going to talk about rebranding the company. People are going to be like, wow, where did this come from, right? Mm-hmm. So probably sort of leading up to it with, you know, indications, you know, hints, questions, you know, sort of leading up to the hard parts, right? Having conversations with people in the company, you know, we're having some business problems or the business isn't growing the way it needs to grow, whatever the issue is. You know, what do you think accounting? What do you think factory? What do you think here, right? And start having those conversations and make sure that people know those conversations are being had. And maybe have them in a reasonable way. I think a lot of times people want to just be real quiet about it because they don't want things to get out to the press or whatever, but you can always have a conversation. You know, you can have it on a continuous basis. You can say, well, no, what do you think we should be doing? And you just have it as part of your everyday because we don't have so much, you know, years and years of stability and a little punctuated moment of change. I think we really have kind of like little bits of stability and lots of changes coming along. And so, you know, the sort of having these conversations on a regular basis is probably not a bad way of going about introducing significant change, at least to me, something in that nature. I mean, I'm thinking about, is it honest? Is it perceived as honest? Is it transparent? Do people perceive it's transparent? Is it genuinely transparent? You know, all of those things to where people aren't feeling betrayed, that there's no chance for backlash, that there's no chance for breaking trust, right? That there's only chance for growing trust, that there's only chance for people sort of having a stronger relationship, right? So those are the sort of the principles that I might, you know, given our conversation today, that I might actually stick with.
That's great. That's fantastic. It's really driving it a lot of those foundational pillars that drive out thinking and behavior, isn't it? I mean, if those aren't there, like then nothing else is going to work, right?
I think so. Yeah, then it just gets to be a fight. I mean, and then, you know, management always has control so much, right? It doesn't necessarily translate into sound business performance, but it does, you know, management can always fire people. You know, or whatever, depending on the laws of the country or whatever. But, you know, that's not really a way to maintain strong relationships and be able to evolve on a continuous basis and have people be a part of it.
Absolutely. Well, that's fantastic. Really appreciate your time, Tony. We have lots of nuggets. I actually scribbled quite a few things just talking to you as well. And I think absolutely our listeners would definitely take a lot out of this. And I hope it would change a lot of how they would approach the change initiatives as well. So again, thanks so much, Tony, and really appreciate a lot of your insights and very refreshing for us as change managers.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, I hope it was helpful.
Thanks.